This is Ann Fisher. The program you are about to hear is a special panel discussion about pandemic flu. It was recorded live a few weeks ago at the Barnes & Noble Bookstore in the South Campus Gateway. We gathered with a studio audience to talk about local author Carla Buckley's debut novel, The Things That Keep Us Here. The story is set in Columbus, Ohio, and Buckley consulted with two Ohio State University scientists for the story. Dr. Armando Hoet and Dr. Richard Slemons joined Carla and I to talk about what would happen if there was an avian flu outbreak around the world, and the science behind pandemic flu research. Thanks for joining us today, and enjoy the show. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. For most people, the idea of a killer, virulent epidemic or pandemic is the stuff of science fiction. Not so for the professionals, the scientists, and the others who look for these things out there. Carla Buckley, in her debut novel, The Things That Keep Us Here, has combined the point of view of the ordinary Central Ohio family with that of the real science of a pandemic to imagine a story about what if and what would happen. How would we react? Carla, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann, for having me.
To give her story about a family in Columbus authenticity, Carla consulted with two Ohio State University scientists, Dr. Armando Hoet. Dr. Hoet, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And also Dr. Richard Slemons. Dr. Slemons, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Carla, why don't you give us a quick synopsis of the story? Just kind of get us up to date on you know, what your thoughts were about it and what the story is about.
Well, I had been writing mysteries for a long time and veered off the path when I decided to write this book instead. And The Things That Keep Us Here is about a family, as you say, in Central Ohio, faced with a very real avian influenza pandemic and how they come together or don't come together in their struggle to survive.
So why avian flu? Why is that the crisis in the story?
When Tim and I, my husband and I, moved here with our children in 2007, we didn't know anybody. And my husband went off to work, the kids went off to school, I was alone writing in my den, and felt very isolated. And news reports of bird flu, H5N1, were circulating and gaining heat. And every night on the news, there were reports about how the scientists were watching this virus, and it seemed imminent. And I had a nightmare. And in the nightmare, I was faced with a crisis. And when I woke up the next morning, I was describing the nightmare to my sister, and she said, "That's the book you should be writing." So that's how it came about. I really wanted it to be a personal examination of what a family would feel and go through if something as terrible as an avian influenza pandemic actually unfolded.
You know, in the book, Peter Brooks, the father of the family, he's a professor of veterinary medicine at a big university. I don't know which one. He also investigates the bird die-offs. And in her acknowledgement, Carla says that you, Dr. Slemons, explained why we should be watching the migratory bird population so closely in these cases. I hadn't occurred to me till I read the book that there are people out there looking for dead birds and actually looking for dead birds, and now I can't drive by a pond without kind of looking, you know, checking it out to see if there's, you know, a couple hundred bird carcasses out there. So are you actually going out into the field and doing this, and how does that work?
Well, I've been looking at avian influenza virus infections in birds for many years, and actually except for rare situations, we don't find dead birds. There's been one situation, 1961, in South Africa, and then, though most recently, with the high-path H5N1 Asian lineage of viruses in Asia mainly, in Southeast Asia, we've seen die-offs in wild birds. But most of the type A influenza viruses, the vast majority of them that circulate in wild birds, are low-pathogenic viruses, meaning they don't cause severe illness, even in chickens, when they're inoculated directly. The problem with them, the reason we've been looking at it so long, is that these viruses have been, as people have looked at them over the years, has come to believe that these are the ancestral origins of varying lengths of time for the genetic material that's for type A influenza viruses that are infecting poultry and pigs and horses and humans, and possibly the ancestral origin of new pandemic viruses.
So if there were to be this sort of virulent killer pandemic, if and when this ever happens, is it conceivable that there would be big die-offs? Is that something you would be looking at?
Well, we would look for that. In the U.S. Department of Interior, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, with the USGS and the National Wildlife Health Laboratory in Madison, Wisconsin, at the University of Wisconsin, in collaboration, they have a laboratory where they look for wild animal die-offs as sentinels, both for wildlife health and, in this case, for human health. So they, in the Department of Agriculture, Veterinary Wildlife Service, have been looking since 2006 for the mortality that might be caused by the Asian lineage of high-path H5N1 viruses in the Western Hemisphere. And fortunately, we've not found that virus in the Western Hemisphere. What a lot of us are doing now, we're looking a little bit more closely with young people that are doing such neat things now in the labs, and we're actually looking at the genetic sequences to see if pieces of genes or genes from the Eastern Hemisphere have been inserted into our wild birds. We wouldn't necessarily expect a die-off in our wild birds, but they have seen it with the H5N1 high-path Asian lineage, especially in Asia. And so it could happen. It could happen here. It is happening in Asia off and on right now.
Dr. Howitt, in her acknowledgments, Carla wrote that you described to her the science behind the avian influenza pandemic, and you showed her how the virus would be handled in the lab. That's a key point in the story. How are these viruses handled in the labs, and how much danger are the people who work with them in the labs exposed to?
Well, you work with infection agents, so every time you work with infection agent, that is an understanding that you are at risk. However, nowadays our labs have different biosafety levels that allow you to work with them in a very safe manner. So in the case of avian influenza, you're working with a low pathogenic, so not the regular ones that Dr. Slemon just described. The biosafety lab level 2, it will be more than enough. There is plenty of protection to protect not only the operators, but also is plenty of protection to avoid these infection agents to go outside the lab and endanger the public or the animal population. If you're working with more severe pathogens, then there are other levels, that biosafety level 3, in which only highly level control of point of entries, that only highly specialized people is going to be able to get inside those labs to work with highly pathogenic avian influenza or anthrax. Here in Ohio State University, we have already all labs, most of us at the College of Veterinary Medicine, are biosafety level 2, so we can work with moderate and high-level pathogens. We also have in OSU a biosafety level 3 lab, and also in the Ohio Department of Agriculture, we have a second biosafety level 3 lab. So we definitely have the capacity to work with these infection agents without exposing ourselves and exposing the population, and we're still able to study them and understand how they work so we can fight them, let me put it that way.
Dr. Hoyt, both you and Dr. Slemons are with the Ohio State University Program of Public Health Preparedness for Infectious Diseases. It's an interdisciplinary approach. Can you tell me a little bit about what you do?
Yes, the PhD is a major program that Ohio State created a couple of years ago in which 7 different health science-oriented colleges, all the way from College of Medicine to Veterinary Medicine, came together to put all of effort and knowledge in regards to infectious diseases and preparedness to work together as a common goal to be ready to face these kind of pandemics that Carla described in her book. And just right now is over 135 researchers, experts in infectious diseases, preparedness, emergency response, molecular techniques, diagnostic techniques, that we work in teams across different areas of expertise to be able to understand how these microorganisms behave, their biology, how they behave in populations, their epidemiology, and to design vaccines and treatments that, in the case that we cannot prevent them from jumping from the animal side to the human side or start to spread in the human population, at least we are able to fight them. Is that the the case.
Are there more of these research teams all over the United States, all over the world?
Definitely, there are several teams already that have, they understand that no one unique profession can really tackle the emergence of infectious diseases like avian influenza. Because we know that in the last 60 to 70 years, 70% or more of the emerging or re-emerging infectious diseases that have affected humans have come from animal populations. So if you are a physician, or you are a biologist, or an entomologist, or a veterinarian, you cannot work anymore alone, because all these problems with emerging infectious diseases across species, across populations, across countries, there is a lot of social issues, food safety issues, so you need experts of different fields. So teams like the, or programs like the PhD, PhD, yes, definitely we are unique in that regard, because there is only three other university campus like OSU that have in the same campus the College of Medicine, the College of Veterinary Medicine, Pharmacy, Food Science and Technology, Environmental Health. There, we are only three in the whole U.S. that have everybody in the same place. And therefore, we are one of the leaders in the field in putting all these different professional experts in one room to share their ideas, to share the labs, to do projects together, and to be able to, as the name implicated, prepare ourselves to deal with infectious diseases that can affect the public health.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break right now. When we return, we'll talk about whether we are prepared or not. Be right back.
An update on health care on what could be a critical week. The president's called for an up or down vote. Plus, a former CIA field officer on the double agent who carried a suicide bomb into a CIA base in eastern Afghanistan. And our regular Wednesday visit with political junkie Ken Rudin. I'm Neil Conan. That and more in the week ahead on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation is here from 2 until 4 right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. And be sure to stay with us this morning at 11 o'clock. Political junkie Ken Rudin will join Ann Fisher for a discussion of all things politics. That's on All Sides at 11 o'clock right here on WOSU 820. 41 degrees in downtown Columbus, clouds today, and a high right around 45. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. You are listening to a panel discussion I hosted recently at the Barnes & Noble Bookstore in the South Campus Gateway. The program was recorded shortly after author Carla Buckley's new novel, The Things That Keep Us Here, was released. The story is a fictional account of what would happen to a suburban family if a pandemic avian flu outbreak occurred. Ohio State University scientists Dr. Armando Hoet and Dr. Richard Slemons were also a part of the panel. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820, NPR News.
Dr. Slemons, Dr. Hoet, that's the ultimate question is, are we prepared? With all of the work you do, all of the hard work you do, you know more than we do, and I'm not sure I want to know everything you know. But there is a question in Carla Buckley's novel, The Things That Keep Us Here, about whether we're prepared, whether we expect someone to come in and, you know, in a helicopter and airlift us out of this mess. And it doesn't work that way at all. What happens if something like this, if a huge, deadly, virulent pandemic breaks out? How do we operate as a society? We don't.
It'll be difficult.
We all laugh nervously, don't we?
Yes. But Carla picked a good virus to look at because that high path Asian lineage of H5N1 virus did stimulate a lot of interest across around the world, not only in the United States. And there has been an increase in funding for preparedness, as everybody knows, across the country, and different concepts. So the program that Amando and I and the rest of the faculty here at OSU are involved in, the public health program, is one example of things that were stimulated by that money. But also the state of Ohio, the health department, Ohio Health Department, Ohio Department of Agriculture, they have programs. Franklin County has an emergency response program team. So there's been a lot of planning and that's gone forth. In the veterinary medicine, we actually, through the Department of Agriculture, have a called OVER program, Ohio Veterinary Emergency Responder Program, where Ohio Department of Agriculture is training veterinarians and training veterinary technicians to recognize and respond to foreign animal disease introductions or emergencies like this. So I can't go much higher than that, but CDC and FAO and everybody, international organizations, have continued to prepare.
All these amazing people have come together to try to, you know, fight this unseen or unknown threat in the future, but there's no guarantee that the folks that have been brought together won't be victimized by it themselves. There's no guarantee that the public health services that we depend on, without thinking today, will be there to help us if 50% of everyone who's infected with it dies, as in the novel. Is that right, Carla? That's pretty much the death rate.
Well, and I don't want to speak for the scientists, but when I wrote the novel, H5N1 at that point did have a mortality rate of 50%.
Case fatality rate of over 50 to 60%.
That's really scary. 60%. It was scary enough at 50. So
I agree.
I mean, if you think about it, so what that means, and correct me if I'm wrong, that half the people who contract this disease
half of the people that develop clinical signs associated with the disease will die.
I mean, that, and in 1918, scientists now estimate that the mortality rate was 20%, and look how horrific that pandemic was.
Of course, things are very different back in 1918. Things have improved. Tell us how things have changed, even from 1976 or 1978, when there were some outbreaks that we never knew about, but you folks knew about them. What's changed since then?
Several things have changed, some for the better, that decrease the probability for major pandemic, like more technology for diagnosis and better technology for vaccine production or antivirals, better knowledge of the epidemiology of how the disease behaves in population and the biology of the virus. But there is also other things that have increased our exposure. We can travel faster around the globe. So in 1920, it takes several days to go across the Atlantic. Right now, you can do it in a matter of hours. There is more of us. There is a lot of difficulty in some areas to access to hospitals or care. There is a lot of conflicts. Sometimes there are problems of food supply. There is a matter of underlying health issues because of that. So in some regards, in some areas we're better than in 1920s, and in some areas we're definitely set it up for a major pandemic like Carla described.
Just want to remind the audience, if you have any questions, we welcome them. And there's a microphone, right? And just raise your hand and we'll get to you. So I welcome your questions.
My name's Wendy. I work in the College of Public Health's Communications Department. And I'm really curious about your nightmare. Can you tell us a little bit about your nightmare and what was it that inspired the novel? I have not read it, and so I'm just curious about the story behind it.
Oh, I'd be happy to share that. Well, as I started to say earlier, I felt very isolated, and having just moved here, and the idea that a pandemic of this nature could erupt at any point made me feel very vulnerable. And my big concern was, how do I protect my children? I know my husband would be in the lab doing his work as chaos rained down, and it would be up to me to try and keep our children safe. Although my husband and I did make an agreement that if WHO went to a certain phase, that he would stay home. Don't mean to air our dirty laundry. So my dream, and I don't want to be specific because actually it's the linchpin of the novel, but my dream was about that conflict. What do I do as a parent? How far will I go as a parent to protect my children? And it was a dilemma that I faced in my dream, and when I woke up,
I was shaken by the choice I made. And I've had a lot of reader response to that dilemma. It's, you can go either way. And I think one of the questions I was keenly interested in asking in this book was, what are our responsibilities as individuals to our children, to our community? Do we come together in our neighborhoods to pool supplies, to support one another? Or do we isolate ourselves in our own homes and pray for the best?
Dr. Hoyt, from a public health standpoint, what would you recommend to people if we're ever faced with these kinds of choices? Gather together to pool our resources or to isolate ourselves in our own homes, because that's easy to do in the suburbs, which is where the story takes place.
Correct. Well, the first thing you have to do is think ahead of time. I always think about that. What happens if I am traveling and there is a major outbreak of infectious disease and they stop flights, how I get home to protect the family? And even myself, I'm not a stronger guy, so if the things go totally chaos and I have to defend my family, you know, use violence, I will not survive too long on that one. Okay? So you definitely have to plan ahead. There are several recommendations. The first thing is have a plan. I was talking with my wife the same way. Okay, what happens if we are apart? What happens if we are together? We talk to the neighbors. You have to prepare yourself. You have to have at least 3 to 5 days of food at home, water, batteries. You have to have a radio. That was my Christmas. That was my Santa Claus this year. Just got a Red Cross radio that can use, you know, solar power or cramp power. And so we are at least connected and hear what is going on if the things really go bad. So it's a little bit of planning. Be sure that you have, as I said, plenty of water, food, because if there is a major pandemic, as Carlos described, and the federal government is capable to keep it together, it will take some time for them to be able to help us. Federal or state government, they will have in mind to do that. But you have to help yourself first. So you have to put yourself in a way that you don't expose you or your family or your neighbors to a worst-case scenario. Listen what the experts tell you to do. If they tell you, stay at home and be quiet for a while, trying to do it. No panic. Don't close the highways. Don't go to places they are telling you not to do it. So it's a little bit of thinking ahead of time, and I'm sure this novel will do exactly that, put people thinking, what will we do if we're in the same situation? So it's basically prepare. And the other thing that is very important, get informed. Because sometimes when you panic, you make the wrong decisions, okay? And when people, when everybody is in that situation, their nerves are just in a touch. And that's when violence generates. So listen, get educated, be ready to respond, and be self-sustained at least for a while. And so you can really respond to this kind of emergency. And it's not only an infectious disease. It could be a major snowstorm. It could be like Katrina that really showed that a natural disaster, if you don't help yourself first, it's very difficult sometimes to get there.
Another question?
I don't think it's a coincidence that we learned of a woman in our neighborhood who, probably around the same time as you, Carla, started... she started a crime block watch, but it was really kind of a health block watch, specifically for avian flu. And her neighbors got together, and they created a plan. And they read, I think they together read the book about the 1918 flu pandemic. And they decided what they would do, and they identified households in their neighborhood that were vulnerable, like elderly and families with young children. And what would they do if people started running out of food and water and all that? And they put together a plan. So there are people out there that had a very similar reaction to you. You wrote a book, and some people actually, you know, started planning. And, you know, that's one of the things I think the CDC had recommended. So I think it's pretty cool. I think the book will be a nice piece to go with a lot of stuff that's already happening.
Not to give anything away, but one of the conflicts for the protagonist in the book is, does she go out into the community? Does she try to work with the community and work with her neighbors, people she's known for years? Or does she hole up in her house with her family and isolate them from as many people as she can? Carla, talk about that conflict. You don't have to say what she decides to do even, but just the conflict in your own mind about that.
Well, I think that, as you said, it's easy, or maybe it was you, Dr. Howitt, was talking about the panic. It's easy to not think, just to react.
The things that she grappled with, the issue she grappled with as far as, you know, she would see her neighbors out repairing their downspout of their house. Could she go to them? Did she feel, but she didn't, you know, would she go to them? And
well,
why wouldn't she?
Well, actually, when the book opens, my couple, Ann and Peter, they're unhappily married. They're on the verge of, they do separate. And so they're living apart when the pandemic hits their community or the world. And Peter, the scientist, is the one who wants to go out into the community, who wants to pull together. And the art teacher, mother of two, wants to stay home and put her arms around her little girls and keep the windows locked. So the two of them combat one another throughout the novel. And the questions arise from that. You know, which way is the best way? Do you join with your neighbors? Or do you close your doors?
There's not an easy answer to that, is there?
No. I think the one statement here about a neighborhood getting together, because I personally feel that if you can work in small groups and maintain basically, we call it in avian or in veterinary medicine, biosecurity, if you can have a small group working together that's relatively closed and supportive of each mm-hmm. other and secure, biosecure, that there's not the traffic coming in and out of that group, maybe the people that are working in the families, whichever spouse, but if they can keep that contained and work together, they're far better off and they can have an immediate response. Because like Amando said, is that I think the local immediate response is the most important one. It'll take time for the federal government, especially in a major disaster, they're not going to be able to help everybody. It's going to be the local response that's going to you're going to survive, help you survive. And the other thing you have to consider about influenza is that it's not a Katrina and it's not a Haiti where the event happens and it's over. This will go on for several months. So having a 3-day or 4 or 5-day supply of food is not going to last. So you're going to have to work in your communities and all to try to keep the infrastructure of the community going. And it's going to depend a lot on the character of the people in the community and each individual situation.
I mean, what you're saying is that people have to trust one another. And if you don't really know your neighbors,
yeah,
or
that's
you're exactly new to the neighborhood, or mm-hmm. you live in an environment where people are transient, how do you pull together? How do yeah. you trust your next-door neighbor to have made the decisions that
correct.
To keep themselves safe, and you're letting them come into your family or your home? And,
correct.
It's a tough call.
If you don't even know the name right. of the person across your street or your apartment, the front door of your building.
Which is so common today.
Exactly. Mm. People don't mind your business. But the problem is that if the situation go bad, okay, in that situation, as I said before, everybody's so scared or panicking about it. That's not the time to make a trusted relationship. Okay, yes, trust me, tell me how much food and water right. you have. Or
right.
what do you have in there? Do you have a weapon there? Nobody will tell you what they have at that time. So if you're concerned about these issues and you want to prepare yourself, knock at the door. Do recover a little mm-hmm. bit of the old culture to bring a cake, mm-hmm. cookies to your neighbor. It's a good excuse. And say you have your own motive to prepare for a major pandemic or a natural disaster. But they don't need to know that on the first day, okay? So
in
they
fact.
Don't put you in the wrong list of, you know, the crazy one.
In other words, get to know
neighbor.
Your neighbors, you know.
Oh,
there's
this one
probably
is crazy. Doomsday.
Benefits. We're going to have to take another break. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We'll be right back with Dr. Richard Slemons, Dr. Armando Howitt, and also author with her debut novel, Carla Buckley. Be right back.
The
This is Capital City Radio.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World.
And this is Capital City Radio.
If you want me to stay, I'll be around today to be available for you.
Capital City Radio is the center of music and news. The new service from WOSU. Online at capitalcityradio.org.
And you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, we'll discuss the latest in political news with NPR's political junkie Ken Rudin. That begins in just about 25 minutes on WOSU 820 NPR News. 41 degrees, cloudy skies today and a high of 45. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. Thanks for joining us.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. Thanks for joining us today for this special program. The show was recorded a few weeks ago at the Barnes & Noble Bookstore on the South Campus Gateway in front of a studio audience. We are discussing local author Carla Buckley's debut novel, The Things That Keep Us Here, a fictionalized account of what a mother and father would do to protect themselves and their children from a flu pandemic. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Joining me today, Carla Buckley, with her debut novel, The Things That Keep Us Here, and also two of her prime consultants on the novel, Dr. Richard Slemons and Dr. Armando Hoet. We were just talking about the importance of the neighborhood, the importance of neighbors, the importance of the family unit. Carla, talk to me about how the idea of the family plays into this novel and how it's defined by this crisis.
Well, you raise a good point, and when I say family, or when I use the word family in the novel, I really mean it can be defined according to any individual. I mean, your family could be your next-door neighbor, or it could be someone who's 1,000 miles away from you. And so how do you respond? Characters in my novel have family living far away, and so there are those pulls against them as well.
The couple in the novel, Anne and Peter, they're separated. The crisis brings them together and unifies them to take care of their children again, and it kind of changes the dynamic of the family again. They end up taking in other people and connecting with other people, and so they're not what you would ordinarily think of as family.
I see.
But the crisis sort of defined and brought into relief what a family
meant.
Right,
and I think that's one of the surprising aspects of the novel as I was writing it, was as the pandemic played out, communities changed and the sense of family changed, and people that you might have considered your friends no longer were your friends, and those who you didn't even know suddenly were now members of the bigger family. And I think, to my mind, that's a realistic. I can picture that happening.
You know, Dr. Slemons, we were talking about if you're prepared and if this and if that. But both of you actually are sort of between a rock and a hard place. If you're doing your job, such as it is, if you're doing it and you're successful, nobody really knows that we've been this close. You know, a pinch away from a full-blown pandemic. How do you feel about that, and how does it help you do your job knowing that it's sort of a thankless job?
Well, I don't work on a very high level, so I don't have that problem. But influenza is a very difficult virus to work with and disease to deal with because it's so unpredictable. And we think we may have been on the precipice, or on the edge of the abyss, one or the other. But we're really not sure the outcome. And there's no negative control, so we don't know where we've been as far as threat. But over the years, we've had several instances where influenza viruses have emerged, and it looked like they will become pandemics. The 1976 swine influenza vaccination program, which was a true swine influenza virus. We started the vaccination program, and then it was implemented, and it was stopped for side effects of the vaccine. but it never happened, so people kind of pulled back. In 1977, we had the Russian flu outbreak, the H1N1 returned again, and that was a true human-adapted virus. And now we've got the H1N1 again, but this is a very different virus. It's a triple assortant virus with different origins of the genetic material from pigs and humans and birds. So each one of these viruses are unique, and we don't know how to respond to it. We can't yet predict which one is going to cause the problem. For example, the H5N1 virus. The virus is still endemic. It's still around. It's in many countries of the world, still killing people. There were 5 different countries that reported human cases or bird cases today. So the virus is around. The threat is still there, and we just do not understand what that virus is doing. So the only thing we can do is what's being done by international organizations and health groups is continue to vigilantly monitor this virus and its activity. So we will have some lead time to prepare if it decides to become a true human pathogen and cause a pandemic.
Sometime after the start of the novel, toward the end, I'm not giving anything away. At the very beginning, they're looking for
a vaccine.
Thank you. Vaccine. They're looking for a vaccine. That's from the very beginning. It feels like we go into these pandemic scares or threats or warnings that there is a vaccine out there. You just have to go get it. And in the case of the latest H1N1, people lined up by the thousands, and there were lots of stories about that. But most people still didn't get the vaccine, did they?
Correct.
So can you talk a little bit about that whole issue? Because I still hear from people saying, I didn't get the vaccine, I didn't get sick, or I got the vaccine and I did get sick, I'm never doing that again. Mm. Talk about what the vaccine is really for. Is it really to save individuals from getting sick, or it's more about the herd, isn't it?
The vaccine works at 2 different levels. The individual level, as you mentioned, is to protect you, to bring your immune system to a level that if you confront the pathogen, you're able to defend it. And even in the case you get infected, then the disease is less likely to occur, and if it happens, it's going to be mild. If you're not vaccinated, probably your immune system will take longer to recognize that pathogen as an enemy, as a foreign germ, and by the time that immune system or your defense system's response, then the disease is definitely going to be already in full mode, and then the damage is going to be more severe. So that's at the individual level. At the collective level that you already mentioned is what we call the herd immunity, is if of 10 people that share the same space, 7 of them get vaccinated, the likelihood of the virus jumping from one human to the next is going to be less. So the spread of disease will definitely slow down, and we make the environment less friendly to this pathogen because we'll not find a susceptible host that allowed to multiply and infect the next susceptible individual. So these 3 guys or person or animals that don't get vaccinated take a full advantage of the collective immunity that is blocking in one way the spread of the disease. So they can easily say, well, I didn't get vaccinated, I got sick. Well, happy for you that you didn't need to use it individually, but you were probably safe because the collective was vaccinated in enough high numbers to create an immunological barrier that stopped the spread of the disease. The problem is when the collective decide, the majority of them, I don't want to get vaccinated. And then you don't have a herd immunity, you only have 30% or even less or whatever the number is, and then they still have plenty of susceptible individuals, and that's when the disease is, even in under vaccination, still can spread. So the recommendation is definitely get vaccinated and be sure that people surrounding you get vaccinated too, especially if you are a high-risk individual.
Can I like to invite the audience? Anyone in the audience? Sure.
Getting back to what you were talking before about introducing yourself to your neighbor, bringing them a cake, one thing I kind of noticed that was interesting, 2 winters ago when we had that ice storm, that knocked out a lot of power in a lot of communities. I work with a lot of college students here. I noticed how much of a difference, generational difference there was with people in my generation that already knew the neighbors, would pool the resources together, would be more comfortable approaching the neighbor and, you know, I got a well water, I still have water, you know, I have a backup generator, charge my cell phone, compared to the college students that don't necessarily have face-to-face connections with their neighbors, but rather they have the technology. They have the internet, the texting, friends and neighbors across the country, across the world, but you're right, they don't know any a soul in the building. Mm-hmm. How do you think future generations are going to adapt, especially when we have, you know, whether, you know, storms or epidemics or anything like that, how are they going to connect with each other, with the future generations, or are they just going to be more isolated and turn more into themselves?
I think I can answer that, but we tweeted it to him.
Right? I'll start following you then.
Yes, okay, okay.
Well, I think that's an excellent question, actually, mm-hmm. and it's something as a mother of teenagers I do worry about. I see my own kids, instead of picking up the phone to talk to their friends, they text them. And many simultaneously, and I do wonder about the breakdown in communication mm-hmm. in the younger generation.
It's based in a cell tower, so yeah. the cell tower just goes away. Mm. Your communication, your line of communication goes away. How you fix that, well, you really have to go very early. Elementary school, middle school, and instruct them in preparedness, including what will happen if you don't have access to internet. It will be good for teachers dealing at that level to tell the kids, especially in high school, okay, let's go this week without cell phone and see how that works. And guarantee you that they will be having issues. And I totally recognize what you say, because my daughter, she needs to talk to me, she's in the second floor, she will call me to the cell. So it's very difficult.
You're listening and watching All Sides with Ann Fisher, my guest, Carla Buckley, author of The Things That Keep Us Here, also Dr. Armando Hoet and Dr. Richard Slemons of Ohio State University. Any questions?
Thank you. Technology. I remember receiving lots of emails from folks that, you know, I know, family members, encouraging me not to get the H1N1 vaccine. You know, fortunately, I've had Dr. Hoet's course, and I know the risk associated with vaccination. But what do you tell those folks who believe that they're receiving a live vaccine that could be infectious when it's not?
How do you respond to folks that try to discourage you?
How do you respond to those folks?
Dr. Hoet?
It's a matter of risk. It's risk perception. If I tell you that if you drive without seatbelt, you are 40% more likely to have in a severe car accident, lose your life. And if you use it, it's less than 10%, then you can see the benefit of using it. However, you still will see emails saying that if you use a seatbelt and you mm-hmm. are in a car crash, you can get beheaded.
For some people, it's the argument is the herd. It is the herd immunity issue mm-hmm. that, you know, if you've made yourself immune to it or had the vaccination, that means you're less likely to infect a six-month-old baby or an 80-year-old woman, that you're going to stop it and that you could save a life by just maybe getting a little sick in the short run. That moves some people.
Correct. You indicate them, it's exactly right. You describe to them what is the risk if you don't do it. And you also have to tell them where is the risk associated if you do it, because you have to provide them enough scientifically based information for them to take the decision if it's something that they would like to do or not. And it has to be clear in that explanation about the risk. If you have it, this is what could happen to you, and if it's not, that what could happen to you too. And make it clear that the balance is always in the favors of getting vaccinated. Okay? We are dealing right now with a major outbreak of mumps in New York, over 300 kids, and none of them were vaccinated because their family believed the vaccine is not the proper way for them to go. And what happened is to make them 100% susceptible to the disease that if you are vaccinated, it will basically do nothing to you. So that's just a typical example. If we go in the case of Carla's scenario, as less people get vaccinated, most likely they're going to get infected, more likely to get disease, and more likely that disease is going to be severe.
And really, ultimately, getting vaccinated is the only thing you can do to protect yourself. Ultimately, mm-hmm. when the vaccine is available, it's that period when the virus has emerged and we don't have a vaccine ready that we're at most risk.
I think another thing that was done during this beginning of this pandemic, especially the beginning of the school year, was the effort to get people to wash their hands and cough into their sleeves. It sounds pretty elementary, but I don't think you can rule out that that didn't play an important role in decreasing the initial impact, the initial spread of that virus, as well as other respiratory diseases. I know in my particular classes that I taught, I had less respiratory disease in the class this year than I normally have. And I think it was because the kids were washing their hands, coughing in their sleeves. They didn't come to class when they were sick. A lot of them would come in and clean their desk area when they sat down. And I think there's simple things like that that can help us before the vaccine and when we do have vaccine.
Around Ohio State, I know they put up dispensers with antibacterial
and they were used.
Wash.
You have to understand that vaccines are not 100% certain that you're going to be protected. Personal hygiene, it plays a major role. Washing your hands, restricting your contact, isolating yourself if you are sick. Be aware what surfaces are you touching, and then again, personal hygiene is very, very important. The other thing is early recognition of disease. If you're feeling that you're coming down disease, then warn the people that you work around or family members that probably you are coming down with something, in this case of this scenario, influenza. So you decrease your exposure. So your vaccine is going to be more efficient that way. So if you decrease the amount of virus that you bring to your nose and to your mouth, the likelihood that the little ones that get there, whatever the source, your immune system is going to be able to deal with that. But if your personal hygiene is very poor, the amount of virus that you're going to bring to your nose or to your eyes or to your mouth is going to be so overwhelming that no matter that you have the perfect vaccine, your immune system is set to fail. And then that's when sometimes people say, oh, vaccine doesn't work because we got vaccinated and failed. Well, you have to evaluate yourself, say, how was your personal hygiene? How much did you wash your hands? What was the people that you were in contact with? How careful were you preparing your food? Or what is the source of your food products? What was the health status of the people that prepared for you? So it's not necessarily the vaccine that fails. It probably was your personal biosecurity that fails.
Another question.
Yeah. Carla, as you chose the background for your book, how did you know to go to a veterinarian to find out about influenza research? Because I think that's probably surprising to many people that veterinarians are the ones doing the research in that area.
Well, I was very fortunate in that I am married to a scientist in public health. And when I decided to write this book, I asked him, I talked it through with him, and he told me, you know, the person who's most at risk is not me or even him, it's the scientist in the field who's testing my wild migratory birds for this virus. I didn't even know that there were scientists doing that. So then my husband said, well, I just happened to have met Dr. Slemons, and maybe he'd be willing to talk to you. And it really took off from there. It was very exciting. I'm a big proponent of research, and the research that I did for this book was tremendous.
What did you learn from visiting and interviewing Dr. Slemons and Dr. Howitt? What surprised you? What did you learn from that process?
Almost everything. Almost everything. In fact, I had a reader contact me yesterday who just read my book, and he wrote me and said, I cannot believe that you went duck hunting. Okay, I didn't go duck hunting, but I talked to Dr. Slemons about the fact that that was an environment in which, well, you could certainly talk about that better than...
Well, we tried to get you duck hunting.
Yes,
it just didn't work out.
Darn it. So I just had to go there in my imagination.
I have some study sites that are very... interesting study sites and very open to receiving people. We just couldn't work the schedule out.
We had weather issues.
Well, she would have probably added another chapter to the book if she'd met our colleagues.
Might have been a different book, Charlie.
She met our colleagues there.
And then Dr. Howitt was instrumental in taking me into the lab and showing me what it's like to actually be a scientist dealing with this virus. And Dr. Howitt, I think you gave me a course in, what's the term, zoonotic disease.
Zoonotic diseases, yes. Diseases transmitted from animals to humans and vice versa.
So the fact that I was able to even attempt to write a scientist is due in large part to these two gentlemen and to my husband.
Are you satisfied with how the science was depicted in the book?
Oh, definitely, yeah. It's interesting to see how she came with the concept, talked to Dr. Slemon, get more solid basis. Then we talked several weeks trying to refine, okay, this is what I'm thinking, is real possible, is scientifically sound. Yes, it is. Well, no, it's not. Then, okay, I cannot say that and go in a different way. Scratch that idea and mm-hmm. go through that. And is to see the final product today, so well-breeding and presented, is mm-hmm. definitely exciting. It's something I have not experienced myself, and it's very cool, as the young people would say.
Some of the best, clearest explanations for what happens that I've read. And it probably helps to have a layperson doing it sometimes and going through that interview process and getting into plain English, because that transference from animal to human is what was very interesting and kind of hard to grasp
fathom.
You know, something that, Carla, that you could have probably exploited more is the terror. And you didn't talk about that. I don't know if you had to tamp it down or what, because it was sort of a nightmare that inspired the book in the first place.
Well, I will say that Linwood Barclay, who is a thriller writer, an international thriller writer, and actually was endorsed my novel, says that my book is scarier than A Room Full of Serial Killers. And I attribute that entirely... I attribute that entirely to the H5N1, not to me. But I think the situation in itself was terrorizing. And I didn't have to exacerbate or exaggerate it to make it scary. In fact, to me, the impact of this novel is that, if there is one, is that it's real and it really could happen to us. And Dr. Howitt, I've quoted you actually behind your back without naming you. At one point during our interview, I asked you, as a father of young children, well, what would you do if you got exposed? I mean, I went after the masks. What if you just wore a mask? I mean, wouldn't that, help keep the disease from spreading in your home? And you said to me, I have a young child, and if she was sick, how could I comfort her wearing a mask? I couldn't. I'd have to remove it. And then you said, it's not a question of if we'll have a pandemic, it's a question of when. And that really carried me through this book, the inevitability of the virus and how we respond as individuals and in the community.
That's all the time we have for the program. Thanks for joining us today. Thanks for being with me. Carla Buckley, author of The Things That Keep Us Here. Also, Dr. Richard Slemons and Dr. Armando Howitt from Ohio State University. Thanks very much for joining me today. And thank you for listening.